You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
How do you know when you're finished with a painting?
How do you know when you're finished making love?
This is Studio 360 from WNYC in New York and Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson. How do you tell for sure when something you create is finally completely done?
I wasn't finished. Did it sound like I was finished?
On today's show, we'll explore the bliss of finishing something well and hear from people who tweak and tweak old works of art to make new improved versions. Last year, when Edward Albee added a whole new act to his classic play, The Zoo Story, he upset at least one of his diehard fans.
When I told people you ruined The Zoo Story?
You told somebody that I'd ruined The Zoo Story? How could you do anything like that? You might be upset, but do be rational, please.
Or take Orson Welles. He spent almost 30 years filming and refilming a version of Don Quixote, and he still couldn't finish.
He liked this movie too much. It was more like a piece of his life than a piece of film.
My guest to talk about all this today is the playwright Tony Kushner. Kushner wrote Angels in America, and his very fine musical Carolina Change opens this weekend in San Francisco. But it is his play Homebody Cobble that went through at least 17 rewrites since it was first staged in 2001. It completed a run last spring at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, and when theater critics asked to see the script, Kushner's handwritten last-minute changes were scribbled on before the copies were made. Tony Kushner, welcome to Studio 360.
It's a pleasure.
And I guess pausing from more rewrites, maybe?
I'm actually done both with Caroline and with Homebody Cobble.
Really? So you're really done?
I'm done. I mean, Caroline is actually finished and Homebody Cobble is abandoned.
Abandoned? That sounds negative and desperate.
It doesn't feel desperate. It's not entirely negative, although I, in a way, wish that I had another 5 or 6 weeks to work on it. But I really promised myself, since I've been working on this thing for 7 years, that when the play opened at BAM, I would stop. And I knew when I first started writing it that I would have a lot of trouble stopping. And so I know it's really time to honor that promise.
It's in the nature of this work that you just wanted to keep going, keep going, keep going?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I could sort of tell at the beginning that I was launching into something that I couldn't really see the end of, and that it was trying to pull together two very, very disparate ideas, storylines, thematic elements, and that doing that was going to be very hard, and it was a huge gamble in the first place. And I could kind of feel that it was going to be one of those plays that you could just spend the rest of your life desperately trying to get right.
And the two basic ideas are, for our
listeners?
Well,
it starts with a woman who's a housewife in London in 1998 who's fantasizing about a trip to Afghanistan, having read an old guidebook to the city of Kabul written in 1965 before the horrors of the last 20 years were visited on Afghanistan. And she's the wife of in a very unhappy family with an unhappy daughter and an unhappy husband. And then there's all of Afghanistan and Afghan history. And in the monologue, which is an hour long, and that's how the play begins, the first thing that I wrote, it balances, I think, her sort of personal misery and the political misery and historical misery in Afghanistan, which, of course, are widely discrepant on any kind of measuring scale. And then in the second part,
Afghanistan has suffered more than she.
Quite a bit more than most of us have. I didn't want to use Afghanistan as sort of a metaphor for her suffering, and she's, in fact, refusing to do that. That's part of what the monologue is about. The second part of the play deals with her having actually gone to Afghanistan right after Clinton bombed the suspected terrorist training camps in Khost.
In 1998,
in August. And she's just happened to be there when this happens. And she is, at least her husband and her daughter are told, that she's been set upon by a mob and torn to pieces in Kabul, mistaken for an American, although she's British. Her family comes to Afghanistan, to Kabul, to try and get her body and bring it back, and the body has been lost, and that starts a whole sort of adventure. And I knew that this sort of family drama set in Afghanistan, but also very much addressing the tragedy of Afghanistan, gave me two very complicated things that apparently had nothing to do with one another, which is always an exciting way to start on a piece. But I knew this one was going to be really tough.
Okay, that's inherent to the piece. But then, okay, you've been working on it for 7 years. It's staged for the first time 3 years ago. What other than your own reaction to seeing actors perform it drives changes? Do you see how the audience reacts? Do you read reviews? What makes you decide to do this differently or expand this or cut that?
I usually try not to read reviews. In Homebody, when it opened at right after 9/11 at New York Theater Workshop, I read a few reviews, or my partner Mark read them to me. I don't actually like to see the print, but I let him read it, and so I could tell you, shut up, so that I don't look. If it starts to get too nasty, I can turn it off
and yell at him instead.
And yell at him instead of the critics, or yell at somebody at least. But actually, it wasn't that they were all that nasty. He actually pointed out, my partner did, that there were a number of complaints that were coming up over and over again, and some of the things that they said, Mark said, you know, if one moron tells you that it's raining outside, it could just be that somebody was pissing on his head. But if 11 morons tell you it's raining, bring an umbrella just in case. So I listened to about 11 critics and then thought, okay, there are certain themes that are emerging here that maybe I should attend to. Things that I was unsatisfied with also in the play. And every time I've heard the play, and this is the scary thing about it, every time I hear it, I think, oh, you know, if I put this old line that I've taken out back in here, or if I take this out, or if I move this plot point around, and it's just clear now. I already have a set of rewrites in my head. If I were going to allow myself, I could do another little set of rewrites at least for the next production. So it's time to stop.
Tony Kushner is my guest today. He wrote Homebody Cobble, as well as Angels in America and other plays. Our first story is about another great American dramatist, Edward Albee. Before Albee won his first, second, or third Pulitzers, and before he ever wrote Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, he was a 20-year-old kid with one play under his belt, a one-act called The Zoo Story. It opened in 1960, and it's one of his most produced plays. But last year, 44 years later, Albee decided to change it. He added a brand new act, a first act, called Home Life, which precedes The Zoo Story that we know. And Sarah Lemanchik had to find out why her hero decided to amend his own classic.
I've been a rabid Edward Albee fan since I was 10 years old, when my dad took me to see a local production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Despite my age and the nature of local theater in Wisconsin, I was hooked. I directed what was probably the first all-Barbie doll version of the play. And now Albee's telling me that I don't know the whole story? As if.
It's a nice day.
Oh, yes, yes, it's lovely.
I've been to the zoo.
The Zoo Story takes place on a bench in Central Park on a Sunday afternoon. This is from a 1960 recording of the play. Peter, a well-heeled man in his 40s, is smoking a pipe and reading. A stranger walks up. This is Jerry, a transient with a lot of questions.
You're not going to have any more kids, are you?
No, no more. Why did you say that? How would you know about that?
The way you cross your legs, maybe. There's something in the voice. Maybe I'm just guessing. Is it your wife?
There is, from the beginning, some malice in Jerry, the transient. He's telling stories laced with sex and violence.
Now look, I don't understand you. Or your landlady, or her dog.
45 minutes after the play has begun, it begins to end. Jerry demands that Peter leave the park bench. Peter refuses. Jerry throws him a knife and demands that they fight. As Peter holds the knife at arm's length, Jerry impales himself upon it and dies. Lou Bellamy runs the Penumbra Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota, and commiserated with me about what I'd begun to refer to as this Albee situation. He was no happier than I that we were about to learn more about Peter in Home Life.
It is true that Jerry is the driving force in the revealing of Peter. But one gets the feeling that Peter could say more if he wanted.
Exactly. So why does Peter stay when Jerry becomes threatening? Why does Peter defend his park bench to the death? These are the questions that launched 1,000 graduate papers. Bellamy says that for him, the Zoo Story revolves around risk, that moment when you first reveal yourself to someone.
And that's where that play lives for me, delving into that moment and just staying there And again, that's what I feared losing when I heard that he was going to explain it further.
The only one who could answer this for us was Albie himself. I needed to know what home life was about.
It's about 43 minutes long. It is about Peter at home with his wife Anne before he goes to the park to read and meets Jerry. I'm not going to tell you what happens during the course of it, because that would be telling.
Telling's the whole problem with home life. Learning more about Peter, for me, destroys the ambiguity of the final moments of the original play.
I know that's because you want Peter to be guilty. More guilty than he is, necessarily. Well, you see, the only reason that I wrote the Home Life, the play to be done with the Zoo Story, making it all into a full evening play, is that the only Peter that we experience in the Zoo Story is the Peter that Jerry wants to see, which may well be the Peter that you want to see, but it is not the Peter who is a complete person.
His ideas make me dizzy. For 20 years, I've known why Peter acted the way he did. Now I find out I might be wrong. I start telling him things I shouldn't. Things like, when I told people you ruined the Zoo Story, a good half of them said, I thought Albie was dead.
You know, that puts you in proper condition to keep on writing plays, because you can be sneaky. He's dead. How come he wrote this new one? I didn't do anything to the Zoo Story. I hope that you corrected the person.
Actually, I didn't.
You mean you said, yes, he's dead?
No, I didn't do that.
You told somebody that I'd ruined the Zoo Story without even having read or knowing anything about home life? How could you do anything like that? You might be upset, but do be rational, please. Give me a fair shot here. I think I know what I'm doing. I think I knew what I was doing when I wrote the Zoo Story originally, and I think know what I'm doing now. And before you make any emotional judgments, he's ruined a play that I love, you should wait and experience what I've done.
I'm both elated and ashamed. I'm talking to one of the greatest living playwrights, my idol, and he's giving me a dressing down. The thing is, I have no doubt that Home Life is a good play. It's Albie for crying out loud. But half his canon is about middle-aged, well-to-do couples. Why change what the Zoo Story is?
Nothing, believe me. Nothing in the experience that you've enjoyed with the Zoo Story over these years, ever since you were 10 years old, you told me, nothing has changed about that. Believe me. And when you see the two together, nothing will have changed. Maybe you will understand a little bit more about why the ending of the play occurs. Not differently, just more. Amplification is different from change.
And yet the Zoo Story has been changed. It will no longer be published or performed on its own as a one-act play. From now on, the Zoo Story will be joined with Home Life and billed as Peter and Jerry. In a very tangible way, my Zoo Story is over. I asked Albie one more question. Had he ever seen anyone successfully amend their work?
Well, no, I've seen the reverse happen. When George Bernard Shaw got it nicely into his 90s, he would reread one of his plays, and he couldn't understand it. It was too complicated for him, and so he would start simplifying it to the point that it became simple-minded, and they had to take his plays away from him so he couldn't ruin them. That'll happen in about 20 years from me. I'll read one of my plays and say, I don't understand this. I better simplify it. But that's 20 years down the road.
Albie told me to go and see Peter and Jerry, and I will. But a part of me, like Peter, still wants to say, I don't understand you, your landlady, or her dog. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Lemanchek.
Edward Albee's expanded two-act version of the Zoo Story, called Peter and Jerry, is slated for a New York run in the fall. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, talking today with Tony Kushner. I wonder, Tony, given your own predilection for writing and rewriting, what you think of what Albie has done here.
Well, that woman is kind of scary.
You must have people like that.
You meet people like that, and there's a sort of an aggrieved, proprietary tone that they take, and it's touching, and it's also a little bit alarming. I think he's right. He's not changing the Zoo Story. He's amplifying it. Even if he rewrote the Zoo Story, if he decided he wanted to actually change the words of the script, there are 100 million copies of the Zoo Story out there. So Edward has only a certain amount of control over what he's doing. The play will outlast him and Sarah and us. And, you know, people in the future will take a look at it, and if what he's done with Peter and Jerry is an improvement or is deemed to be an improvement, or if some people like it better than just doing the Zoo Story alone, they'll do it that way. And if not, the Zoo Story will still be there. It has a whole history of being performed, you know, on its own. And I think it'll go back to that. So I don't, I think in a certain sense, his work, as was the work of Shaw or Whitman, let's say, who changed Song of Myself 100 million times. Every time he put out a new edition of Leaves of Grass, he screwed up the poem more and more. But we still have the 1848 original edition, and it's magnificent, you know, first draft status. And that's what we read now. Nobody goes and reads the ones from the late 19th century.
And you mentioned Whitman, which is an interesting example of a cautionary tale about revising and not thinking you're done. But it seems to me theater and your experience and Edward Albee's experience, theater is almost unique in inviting this to happen because of the nature of the process of production, that things are done in workshops before they ever are staged. And then because they are staged, they don't exist like a novel or a film or a record kind of forever in a piece of amber. The nature of theater is that they get redone.
One of the things that's interesting and unique about theater is that it is inherently a sort of a non-commodifiable art form. The great director Elizabeth Lecomte actually, you know, is there in the theater changing what the Wooster Group does every single night. And every night a show can not have changed in the text at all, but a different audience, a different night, different things having happened in the world that day will radically alter the experience. So it teaches you a pretty, you know, impressive lesson about how resistant to commodification life in some ways still is. And it's sort of one of the joys of theater.
Is that it's unfixed.
It's unfixed and it's perishable and it goes away. And so I think absolutely playwrights are seduced by that kind of magic and the fact that every time it's produced again, Brecht did it a lot. Tennessee Williams did it endlessly. There are 9 versions or something of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and film versions of them. And you sort of go and you pick and you choose and you cut and you paste. We've certainly done that with Shakespeare. I mean, we have an anxiety about text. It's probably because of the Bible. It's supposed to be our guarantor that God exists and is a fixity in eternity and that life is not this endless flux, but life is an endless flux and we're fluxed. And text itself comes and goes and changes all the time, and there are no authoritative versions really of much of anything.
Tony Kushner is my guest, and we're talking about how you know when a play or a piece of music or any work of art is complete. We'll talk more in a bit. Plus, the legendary perfectionist Orson Welles never finished his epic film of Don Quixote. So, what happened to it?
He once said to me, he says, you know, the terrible thing about pictures is they're canned. And I said, what? They're canned. They come in cans, which film does. I said, I've lost you, Orson. I don't know what you're talking about. Well, anything that's canned isn't exactly fresh, is it?
Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the playwright Tony Kushner, and we're talking about trying to finish things. Just how does an artist know when a work is done? In the 17th century, it took Miguel de Cervantes decades to finish Don Quixote, his masterpiece about the old man who starts to believe he's a knight in armor from reading too many romance novels. Lots of filmmakers have tried to capture Quixote and his faithful squire, Sancho Panza. Orson Welles worked on it for 30 years, in fact. But as Gregory Warner explains, Welles's attempt turned into its own quixotic adventure.
If Orson Welles was a perfectionist, it's not just because he wanted to make perfect films. It's that he wanted his films to stay perfect forever. He hated the idea of his art getting stale.
The trick about movies is freshness. That's Orson's point, to keep it fresh.
Director Peter Bogdanovich acted in one of Orson's films and collaborated with him on a book of interviews.
He once said to me, he says, you know, the terrible thing about pictures is they're canned. And I said, what? They're canned. They come in cans, which the film does. I said, I've lost you, Orson. I don't know what you're talking about. Well, anything that's canned isn't exactly fresh, is it?
Orson began filming Don Quixote in Mexico in 1957. He had a cast of four and $25,000 from Frank Sinatra. His idea was to set the novel in the 20th century, but there was no script, and the crew often had no idea where they'd be filming. Each morning they'd follow Orson's car through the Mexican back roads, like Sancho Panza following Quixote to the next adventure, and where he stopped, they set up their cameras. Orson's money ran out after a month of this, and he left for Hollywood to direct Touch of Evil. And this would become a pattern for the next two decades. Wells would squeeze Don Quixote in between paying projects, or he'd piggyback the two, acting in one movie by night and filming Don Quixote by day. His elderly actors, working practically for free, slept in blankets on his movie sets. But they never saw the fruits of their labor. In fact, very few people ever got to see Don Quixote. Again, Peter Bogdanovich.
I kept begging him to show me some of Don Quixote, and we were in Rome. He said, I'm going to show you some of Don Quixote. And, oh, good. We sit down at the steam bag, and he shows it to me triple speed. He runs it through silent and triple speed. I said, Orson, how can I watch it this way? You can see it this way. You can get the idea. See, there it goes. Look, you can see it. He didn't want to have to sit there and watch you watch it.
The actors playing Sancho Panza and Don Quixote both died in the early 70s. But with no studio to answer to, Orson was free to keep tinkering with the footage, up to his death in 1985. By then, he had retitled the film, When Are You Going to Finish, Don Quixote? 7 years later, Don Quixote was finished by a Spanish director named Jess Franco. Franco had acquired the rights to the film with the help of the Spanish government, mostly because he had worked on another Orson film, Chimes at Midnight, in 1965. But Jess Franco is best known for his B-movie horror flicks and the sort of softcore porn that used to be called art films.
I really dug that chick. Look, I knew she ran around with the Riviera Greek Island yachting crowd. And I wasn't in her league. But I wanted to be.
Films like Venus in Furs and Succubus, the first X-rated film released in America, and about 200 other films. Because unlike Orson Welles, Franco is famous for getting films finished. But even Franco spent over 2 years on Don Quixote, first finding the footage, and most of what he could find were corroding reels in cardboard boxes in a basement in Hollywood.
And I found myself with 120,000 meters of film. I've never had that much material. In 10 years of different movies, maybe. And there were very different types. 35 millimeter, negatives, countertypes, some were shot in good Kodak. Some material was just disintegrating.
The footage was also weirdly labeled. One shot might be marked as Sancho 1, and the very next shot, Wall 1. And the whole film was filmed without sound. Orson recorded the sound himself, on separate tapes in the editing room, improvising alone the voice of both Don Quixote.
Let me tell you, Sancho, that knights errant pride themselves on not eating for as long as a month.
And Sancho Panza.
Oh, come on now, just a little piece of wing? I'll bring it to you. It won't break your fast. No.
Franco had to match these dialogues to any one of a dozen scenes. Again, Jess Franco.
The thing is that Orson used to shoot 20 times the same scene. 20 times doesn't mean 20 takes. Mean 20 times.
Franco's film, Don Quixote de Orson Welles, was released at the Cannes Festival in 1992 to nearly universal disdain. Some were offended by the film's quality, some by Franco himself. They said this version was too much Franco and not enough Orson. Here's Franco.
It's not like I'm in love with this edition, but I know that it's one of Orson's productions, because he never knew anything for sure. So I'm sure if he were alive, he would have shot 20 times more and he would have changed everything. He liked this movie too much. It was more like a piece of his life than a piece of film.
Is Franco's version really one that Orson might have made? Well, this year, a rival version of Don Quixote, put together by Italian editor Mauro Bonanni, was screened for film buffs in New York and Munich. His version was only 40 minutes long, but it was based on things Benigni had seen working with Orson in 1969. I called Benigni in Rome.
I began in 1969. I was 21. One day, I received a call from an assistant working on the set with Orson Welles, and he asked me if I wanted to work as an editor. We worked on many television specials for the BBC. Then one day, Orson came in the editing room with two suitcases and said, "Now I will show you my son." I said, "What do you mean your son? You have a daughter." And he opened the bags, and it was Don Quixote.
Benigni claims to hold the original negatives for Don Quixote in a vault in Italy. He assembled this 40-minute sampler to show that Franco got it wrong. But he says in 1969, Orson did put together a full-length version of Quixote. Parts were a little rough, but mostly all it missed was one tiny scene, which Orson promised to choose just before the film's release.
Sancho Panza si ferma, vede una televisione.
All of a sudden, Sancho Panza stops abruptly and sees a television set on the ground, and he starts watching. Clearly on the TV set, there's nothing. I asked Orson, "What will go here?" He told me, "Mauro, what will go here will be the most important event that occurs at the time we release the film. A few years ago, it could have been the explosion of the atomic bomb. Today, it could be the landing of men on the moon. And today, it could be the Twin Towers."
Benigni no longer has that near-finished version. He says Orson probably took it apart to start all over again. In the final pages of Cervantes' novel, Don Quixote realizes that his epic quest has been a delusion, and he immediately falls ill and dies. Maybe by not finishing his Quixote, Orson held on to something more precious to him than one more canned film. For Studio 360, I'm Gregory Warner.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with my guest, the playwright Tony Kushner. Tony, are you a fan of Orson Welles?
Oh, of course. Everybody is. He's really an extraordinary filmmaker, and I'd heard, not in quite as much detail, but I've heard that he was struggling with this Don Quixote film for years and that it was essentially incompletable.
Well, it does. I mean, looking at the last 30 years of his life as a great fan of what he did, you know, especially in the 20 years preceding the last 30 years, you wonder if there wasn't something pathological about this, that he didn't want to finish it, that it was just a thing he wanted to be permanently incomplete.
Well, yeah, when you show up in a mixing studio with a suitcase and say, "I'm going to show you my son," I'm sure it flashed through everybody's mind at the moment. He's got somebody's chopped up body in the suitcases. I mean, he was obviously a person with a degree of madness, and he always had it. So it's I think that, you know, clearly, listening to what we just listened to, the guy was, you know, this was a kind of an obsessional and an unreal object, although it's incredibly great that it would be Don Quixote, and that I'm sure, you know, as smart as he was, he realized that, you know, in a way, all versions of Don Quixote that aren't the book are going to fail. It's like Moby Dick. It's a book about a book. It's about bookness, and you take it out of that and you lose 90% of what makes it astonishing. It's about a sickness that literature produces and the way that literature reproduces itself by producing this sickness. And it sounds like, in a way, Welles, by trying to make a film that's never canned, that's never becomes finally the finished object that most film becomes, was trying to sort of replicate that experience in filmmaking. And it was a very personal sort of almost autistic kind of endeavor, it sounds like.
Well, and speaking of sort of unfinishedness, certainly in modern Hollywood, I'm struck that the kind of term of art for a script is not a script, but a draft, implying that it's you, the schmuck with the Underwood, aren't really going to finish it.
Yeah, well, of course, it's automatically assumed that, you know, there's you and then there's the six people that will come after you who will take the work over, and it's a terrifying thing about writing screenplays.
Have you ever rewritten somebody else's work?
I'm doing it now. I just took my first script doctoring job.
How is that?
Spooky. And I feel terribly guilty. And I feel like I'm going to have to apologize. And I'm going to have really bad karma for having done this. There are like four or five people before me. They've now started sending versions of the script that don't have the title
all
page.
The names?
No one's name. They sort of took that off, and you just get the script starting with, you know, scene one.
Interior. What's the movie?
I can't say. I'm sworn to secrecy. And it's the first one that I've been asked to do it before, but I decided to try it because it's a way of making money. And it's a project that I'm interested in, and I think that I can help make it better. And then I have no doubt that there'll be somebody after me who will, you know,
finish it.
Cut my head off and finish it or not.
My guest today is the playwright Tony Kushner. His play Carolina Change is on Broadway right now and up for 6 Tony Awards this weekend, including Best Musical. I'm Kurt Anderson. For most of us, when we pop a CD in by our favorite band, we're just listening to the music and the musicians, we think. We probably don't think that what we're hearing is the result of 1,000 or 10,000 careful choices that a producer has made.
Bruce, could you come in here for a second, please?
That was going to be a great track. Guys, what's the deal?
Are you sure that was sounding okay?
I'll be honest, fellas, it was sounding great, but I could have used a little more cowbell.
That was Christopher Walken in a brilliant Saturday Night Live sketch about a studio session with a record producer. Too much meddling, like demanding more cowbell, can ruin a record. But it's actually the industry standard to do lots and lots of tweaking and layering of track after track. The studio producer Ethan Johns rejects that approach. He tries to get the finished sound in a more old-fashioned way. Trey Kay caught up with Johns while he was in the studio recording the band The Kings of Leon.
Ethan Johns believes that if he's prepared and the band's prepared, the perfect sound will happen right there in the studio, live. And if he's got his ears open, he'll hear it. We visited Ethan on a day when he was working with the band Kings of Leon, and he was recording them in the old school way, live to 2-inch analog tape.
Working live, I think ultimately it comes down to communication between musicians. It's about performances inspiring other performances. It's a spiraling effect.
Maybe we try bringing everything else down and cranking Caleb's...
At this session, Johns is a little frustrated because the band's frontman, Caleb Followill, is unable to sing.
It's a lot harder to do without a vocal. I mean, the vocal to me is everything. That's the focus of the track. Unfortunately, the singer today doesn't have a voice. He's blown his voice out, so our schedule dictates that we must record today without the vocal, which I don't like doing. It's a lot harder for me.
While the Kings of Leon lay down their tracks, John stays in the room with them while they work, keeping his ears open for a clean performance that is special.
String. Wasn't sounding that good anyway.
After 2 or 3 takes, Johns and the Kings listen and critique the playback.
Well, there was some good stuff in there, for sure. The only part that seems to be kind of tripping us up is when you sort of transfer from the boom, 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 brap, boom, 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 brap, getting that roll, getting that tom feel. It's usually the first of the two is a little, takes a minute to sort of settle in, and then the second time you play it, it's always perfect. So maybe we should...
I asked Johns how long it could take before hitting pay dirt with a great take.
I don't know. It's such an incredible process. It's a bit of a luxury, put it this way. When the take is done and you stand up and you go, that was it. That doesn't happen that often. You usually have to go back, play back. There's a lot of concerted listening.
He told me in other sessions he's been psyched about a take, but that the artist just doesn't share his enthusiasm.
You know, I mean, it happened on the last record I made. I was, you know, it was one of the most beautiful takes, completely live, string quartets. Just brought me to tears. I mean, slayed me. I was actually playing at the time. It completely slayed me. I barely finished the take. But the artist comes in and, you know, on playback, and, you know, they're not sure about it. You know, it's because if this is their record, you know.
What did you do when that happened?
Well, I got forceful. No, I really believed in it, and the general consensus was that it was an extraordinary recording. I honestly felt truly blessed to be in the room, and you know, to have been able to capture what happened. And I think the artist is coming round to realizing what it is that we've got.
I asked Ethan how he would know when it was done.
Yes, the question, the big question: when is art finished? When do you walk away? It seems to be an unanswerable question in my mind, and it is a question that has been dogging me for 20 years. You know, I can't put it into words. I can, on a session, stand back from whatever it is that's happening and go, that is unique, that is complete.
For Studio 360, I'm Trey Kay.
So close. I mean, it's really...
Do you want to listen to the one before you go?
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, talking today with Tony Kushner. Tony, when you are in whatever equivalent room you're in, when you're in the middle of trying to get a play up, is there, if not literally the producer, a figure like that to whom you listen or want to listen? Are there ears you really trust?
When I'm writing the thing, I don't show my work to anyone until I'm either done with the first or second draft, and I write everything by longhand and then type it into a computer, so in a sense nobody ever sees anything but a second or a third draft, unless I get really stuck and I need somebody to say, keep going. I mean, there's that terrible story about Flaubert finishing The Temptation of St. Anthony and spending 17 hours reading it to his two closest friends, who were silent at the end and said, okay, you have to destroy this immediately and never show it to anyone. And he did, and then went and had to rewrite the entire thing again, so you have to be careful, I think, who you're going to show it to. I have a couple of friends who I know I can trust. If what I want really is encouragement, is somebody to say, you know, it doesn't sound so bad, so you're not so lonely, then there are people I trust. And then once you're in production, the great thing about being a playwright is you have a director, you have actors who have this incredible ability in 2 seconds to sort of take over the play, even if it's not finished, really. They know those characters, and if they're really good actors, the characters sort of become theirs in a way, and they can become like mind detectors for you. They know where you've misstepped, and they won't go down that road if their character wouldn't do it. And if you've got a really great actor who's not just throwing, you know, a temperament fit, you can really rely on them to teach you things.
So effectively, they kind of help you finish it.
And then the audience, because the audience starts coughing when its attention begins to wane.
Is that the fatal sound in a theater?
It's a terrible sound. You can't avoid it, especially now with the air as bad as it is. You know, everybody's got emphysema. But there's a dead, quiet sound of an audience listening. I mean, there's also laughter and there's crying, and those are very distinct sounds as well. And when you get an audience just completely wrapped, you know you're really okay. And then you start to hear shuffling and coughing when it goes on too long, or you know, some they've lost their way, they've become confused, they become a little restless. And if you learn how to listen for that and think, okay, where did I lose them? How did the play go this way and they stayed, you know, here? You can start to rewrite the play to sort of not let them go. And that's a big part of the act of the art of writing a play in previews.
Do you ever start writing something with a last line, a last scene, a last moment in mind, so in some sense you know when you're done because you get to that point?
Sometimes with a final event, but actually very rarely even that, and never a last line. No, I mean, I kind of have a general idea of the plot of the play, of the action of the play. I mean, actually, a fairly specific idea. It can change on its way, and you have to keep reinventing the play as you go along. But I'm never entirely sure what path I'm going to take to get there.
I'm Kurt Anderson with Tony Kushner, and we will talk some more in a minute. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Thank you. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with Tony Kushner. He is the playwright of Angels in America and Homebody Cobble. His latest show is the musical Carolina Change. Last fall, it ran on Broadway, and it opens at the Curran Theater in San Francisco this weekend. We are talking about the moment or moments that artists know their work is finished. And, Tony, I want to play something for you now.
Ain't never been no good finding joy the way you should. Hoping water turned to wine. Hope's fine. Ah, hope's fine. Hope's fine. Till it turned to mud. And some folks go to school at night. Some folks march for civil rights. And I don't. I ain't got the heart. I can't hardly breathe.
That was Tanya Pinkins playing the title character in Carolina Change. She is extraordinary in that role, really. I mean, it's a wonderful play, nice music, but it's hard to imagine without her doing it.
Yeah, when I brought it to George, after I finished writing the libretto, I brought it before I'd met Janine, who is the composer, Janine Tesori. I brought it to George Wolfe to direct it, and I said, would you do this? And he said, yes, but I know who has to play the lead. And I said, who? And he said, Tanya Pinkins. And I said, well, that's perfect. It's exactly right. She even weirdly slightly resembles the woman that Caroline is loosely based on.
A person from your own childhood?
Yeah, a woman named Maudie Davis, to whom the play is dedicated. She came up to see the play in New York, and the first thing she said was, that woman looks just like me. So, I mean, it's a strange...
What did she think of the play about
her? She was very moved. I mean, it's not really about her because it's sort of a loosely autobiographical. But she was a
figure in your and a caregiver, as we say today, in your life.
She was domestic. She wasn't a caregiver. In fact, one of the things that made her really interesting to me as a kid is that she wasn't interested in giving care. She was a very stern, hardworking woman who, you know, did the cleaning and
gave you cigarettes like Caroline
no,
that gets the kid
that
in the play?
That part is made up. There's a whole thing about cigarettes and cancer in the play that I think that just sort of suggested itself. But the cigarettes are a very, very tiny connection that this woman has with this little boy. It was a way of dramatizing something that I felt with Maudie. And she seemed to recognize our past life together and some aspects of her life in the play. She was very, very happy about it and fond of it.
Now, the story of the play doesn't resolve itself in a nice, happy, tidy ending at all.
It's pretty dark.
Well, therefore, how did you know when you were done with it?
Well, the song that we were just listening to, which is called Lot's Wife, that song was always, that's what we call in musical theater, the 11 o'clock number. I mean, it's this really huge moment towards the end of the second act. There was a certain amount of pressure from a lot of different places to... because it's a musical play, it's expensive. Audiences expect a kind of a happy ending. And in theater, we're sort of conditioned to sort of want to say, well, at the beginning, person X has such and such a set of problems, and an hour and a half later or 2 hours later, they've figured those problems out.
I think that's movies and popular fiction and everything, isn't
it? And everything. And, of course, it's weird because no one changes that quickly. No one changes with any certainty. There's always the possibility of backsliding. And most people spend their lives struggling mightily to change, you know, a tiny little habit like chewing your nails. And what people go to the theater or read books to or go to movies and expect to see is that people can sort of revolutionize themselves within a very, very short time. And I reject that. I think that that's a kind of a false entertainment. It's anodyne. It's promising people things that don't happen. And I think all that it really produces is intense personal despair in the audience because one knows that one is oneself incapable of such transformation. And this is a character who struggles mightily but doesn't transform. I had to really insist on that as being kind of the key. But the form of the song changed over and over and over again to find an expression. And there are versions of it that are happy. There are versions that are very optimistic that sound like, I think, a graduation speech. And we finally came back to the original vision of that scene, but in a much more developed and nuanced way. And the minute it's actually a moment of great pride for all of us because we worked on it up until previews. It was the very last thing that it had the last huge rewrite was that song. The last version, we had this huge meltdown, screaming argument with everybody sort of giving their ideas about it. And I got on the phone with George after the big argument, and I said, okay, well, I think I'm going to do this and a little bit of this. And he said, no, I want you to go home, forget everything that everybody else said. everything I've said, everything Janine said, Tanya, do your own version of this. You're the only one who's going to really nail it for the words and then bring it in for Janine, and we're just going to drop out now. And I did, and that night I wrote the version of it that you hear in the words, and I brought it to Janine, and I think literally within an hour it was set to music. We played it for ourselves. We both knew immediately that's it. We brought George in. He listened. He said that was it. Tanya learned it in like 2 seconds. She's a very fast study. And that night the audience, when she finished, screamed, and we thought, okay, so it's done, and it works, and when it works, it works.
That's like, you know, 42nd Street or a movie.
Yeah, it was a little bit like 42nd. It felt really good. I felt like a real Tin Pan Alley, songwriter.
Tony Kushner, thanks very much for joining me today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Really lovely.
Tony Kushner's Caroliner Change, starring Tanya Pinkins, is playing at the Curran Theater in San Francisco until February 20th. Today in Design for the Real World, we are looking at one of the most urgent design problems on the planet: how to shelter the millions of people displaced by the tsunami disaster in South Asia. When money and expertise for construction are limited, refugee camps can easily turn into semi-permanent cities where survivors spend years in tents and shanties under awful conditions. But while the UN's refugee agency is right now distributing plastic tarps for emergency shelters, some committed designers are figuring out how to rebuild homes that might last. Dave Johns has the story.
On the morning of December 26th, Samir Shah was asleep in his house in Colombo, Sri Lanka, when he was awakened by a phone call from his friend Lori. She wanted to know if his house was flooded. He was groggy and confused. The sky was clear, and it hadn't rained in weeks. But she said there was water up to her ankles in her house, and she could see it had swelled up to the window sashes outside. Samir turned on the BBC and saw the first news flash about the tidal wave.
You know, it was obviously kind of devastating, and it took me a little while to kind of figure out what I could do, if anything.
Samir's a North Carolina-born architect. He was in Sri Lanka on a Fulbright to study the country's vernacular architecture. The tsunami changed his plans.
It occurred to me, obviously, that there would be massive reconstruction. I mean, people are basically being put up in schools, in community centers, in temples. There's 500 people to a toilet.
So he decided to get in touch with Architecture for Humanity, a New York-based nonprofit that connects designers with projects in the humanitarian world. The group had launched an appeal for reconstruction funds within hours of the disaster, and Shaw soon found himself in charge of the group's Sri Lanka operation. The dilemma that he and other local authorities face is one common to refugee crises: how to build truly temporary housing.
The problem, particularly in this part of the world, is if you build anything temporarily, it becomes permanent. And they're trying to look at this as an opportunity to make the coastline and make Sri Lanka better. But, that takes time and people are getting anxious.
Temporary structures for refugees today still often take the form of giant tent cities that sometimes house families for years. Plastic sheeting and tent poles remain the emergency materials of choice for most international aid organizations. Tarps are warehoused in massive numbers in strategic locations around the world. But they have serious limitations, according to Cameron Sinclair, the founder of Architecture for Humanity.
There's no infrastructure, so the first thing that goes is the sanitation, and then you have waterborne diseases. And so you end up having more people dying after they've been rescued than died during the incident. So we're saying, like, tents are great, but not in the long run and not in the temporary term. I mean, they're more immediate. And we need to try and develop a housing structure that bridges the two.
Sinclair's nonprofit has sponsored several design competitions to spur the creation of innovative ideas for transitional housing. The hard part is to come up with something that's truly as cheap and portable as the tent. Most ideas never make it past the prototype phase.
Here it is.
Yeah. So tell me exactly what we have here.
But Daniel Ferrara, a designer in Morris, Connecticut, is a step further with the cardboard houses he calls Global Village Shelters.
Why don't you step inside and you can sort of see, you can get a feeling of what it feels like.
Yeah, let me just go on in here and see.
He's partnered with the paper company Weyerhaeuser to mass produce simple miniature homes that cost $370 a piece. They're made of a stiff, laminated material that he says has withstood several snowy New England winters. And he says they're fire and waterproof, too.
Well, you can see now, when you're inside, it has a much stronger feeling than a tent. You know, it feels like a room in here.
Inside, they're about 8 feet by 8 feet, room enough to sleep four comfortably. There's a small window and a door that latches on the inside. Ferrara recently sent 100 of the units to hurricane-ravaged Grenada. They're shipped as 2 folded-up flat packs and can be assembled with no tools in less than 15 minutes. Still, many shelter advocates argue there's just no one-size-fits-all solution for temporary shelter. Lisa Dubin, an architect who's authored a best practices manual on shelter design for the International Rescue Committee, says the best shelters are made from local materials.
What's really important in emergency housing is to be able to provide materials that are very easily accessible. In many places, they've used mud brick, which is a really appropriate and wonderful material because there's always dirt.
That's the kind of thing Samir Shah is thinking about in Corinda, a small fishing village wrecked by the tsunami where he's consulting with local officials on temporary housing. They're building 4-unit shelters using local labor and locally purchased concrete, timber, rock, and sod.
More than anything, what we're trying to do is to have a process where we think about the community planning beforehand and that we rebuild a real village, not a camp.
That's the main goal of everyone involved in humanitarian design, says Cameron Sinclair, to broaden the thinking about what temporary shelters could look like.
I mean, if you gave somebody a piece of plastic and said, by the way, you're going to live in this for 5 years, I'm not sure if it's worth living after you've lost everything. But if you tell somebody, look, we've got a system and you can build it and develop it and it can become a permanent structure for you to live in, you know, at least you're providing hope. You know, I think it's important that we look at the long-term strategies, and this is where design can really make a difference.
For Studio 360, I'm Dave Johns.
You can find out more about Architecture for Humanity and its tsunami rebuilding efforts at studio360.org. The annual parlor game debating the Academy Award for Best Picture now begins in earnest. The nominations will be announced in a couple of weeks, and this year the speculation is fervid because the race seems so wide open. No single movie is the big front runner.
Mr. Incredible, we need your help.
Including The Incredibles, the animated story of a family of superheroes that was fantastic in every sense, and I'll say here,
showtime.
The best movie of 2004. But I also find it interesting to try to suss out the year's interplay of quality and commerce. What kinds of movies performed best at the box office and why? Here now, based on the movies of 2004, are the 7 habits of highly effective Hollywood executives. Number 1. Unless you're producing a huge movie directed at kids, Lord of the Rings last year, The Incredibles this year, you can forget about making a lot of money and being the subject of Oscar buzz. It's not that the Motion Picture Academy penalizes commercial success, it's that audiences don't tend to reward high quality. The Day After Tomorrow, a silly movie about environmental apocalypse, grossed $187 million at the box office. Sideways and Finding Neverland have each made about a tenth as much. Number 2, if you want to produce a serious drama, make it an action picture. Among the biggest grossing 30 films this last year, only one is a traditional drama in which the characters don't shoot or stab or blow up each other. All the other dramas, The Bourne Identity, Collateral, Hero, are full of mayhem. The good news? Most of them were good films. Number 3, if you want to make a commercially successful comedy, it must either be animated, like Shrek 2 or Shark Tale or The Incredibles, or else star Ben Stiller or Adam Sandler.
Sorry, I'm not better looking.
Stiller and Sandler were in most of the most successful comedies of 2004. Number 4, even if you're not making a comedy, don't make it a completely humorless film.
Do you know what's there?
waiting beyond that beach. Immortality! Take it! It's yours!
Several expensive humorless movies failed big this year. King Arthur, The Village, Troy. In fact, absolute humorlessness rarely succeeds. Only twice in 2004, by my count, with The Bourne Identity and The Passion of the Christ. Number 5. Beware the period picture. There were about a dozen such movies last year, and weirdly, none was a real commercial success. Whether they were set in ancient times, like Alexander and Troy, or the Dark Ages, like King Arthur, or the first half of the 20th century, like Finding Neverland, or DeLovely, or Sky Captain. Bombs, bombs, and more bombs. Thus, number 6. The only period films that succeed have supernatural subjects, like the martial arts epic Hero, the gothic monster movie Van Helsing, and The Passion of the Christ. Number 7. Finally, if you want to produce a money-making political film, make sure it's ideologically unambiguous. Fahrenheit 9/11 was a huge hit. The Manchurian Candidate, with its complicated politics, and Team America, which made fun of both left and right, were not. This is Kurt Anderson. You have been listening to Studio 360, and I really hope you'll join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
David Krasnow,
Lital Mulad,
Michelle Siegel,
Ave Carrillo,
Eric Malinsky,
Lauren Shea.
Our theme music was composed by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360 is also supported by individual donors to PRI, whose contributions help bring innovation to public radio. Information at PRI.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Violetta is not only saying goodbye, but she recognizes how much she's giving up.
A woman torn between shaming her true love or returning to walking the streets.
You know, I get chills just thinking about it, no matter how many times I did it.
Verdi's La Traviata, next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.